After the LIDAR flight, where the whole area was surveyed in a matter of days and discovered these cities in the valley, there was then the task of getting your boots on the ground and going in. And you spent a lot of time in your book describing that. Was it as inhospitable as you expected?
So in 2015, we launched a joint Honduran-American expedition into this valley of T1. We flew in on helicopters, and we had a team of three British ex-SAS jungle warfare specialist soldiers with us, whose job it was to keep us alive. I'll never forget them giving us this lecture about the dangers of the jungle and the diseases, the poisonous snakes, the animals that we might encounter, the insects, the scorpions, the spiders, the ants that bite you and require hospitalization, you know, on and on. And I just thought, well, you know, they're exaggerating the hostility of the jungle for the benefit of people who aren't experienced in wilderness travel, which I was. So I kind of dismissed it all as exaggeration. And when we arrived there by helicopter, it was a beautiful sunny day. There were no insects. The temperature was a balmy 75 degrees. And I looked around thinking, what a bunch of hogwash about how dangerous this jungle is.
This is tropical paradise.
Well, yeah, they said, this is a paradise. I mean, there were flowers. There were beautiful birds, bird of paradise flowers everywhere. There were the trees were gigantic. Some of these trees had trunks that were 20 feet in diameter. The animals apparently had never seen people before. They just wandered up to us. But that night, we had our wake-up call. It was pitch dark, you know, in the jungle at night. It's just so dark. It's like being in a cave. I was walking back to my hammock, and my flashlight fell on a giant Fer-de-Lance snake, which is the most venomous snake in the New World, coiled up, very aroused, in striking position, tracking me. And I'd walked by this snake twice. So I called out. Now, I think I kept my voice calm, but they claim I was yelling. But I said, hey, you guys, there's a really big snake here. And Woody, who was the chief British logistics expert of the expedition, said, oh, my God, it's a Fer-de-Lance. It's one of the biggest I've ever seen. I'm going to move it. And I thought, how is he going to move that snake? That's crazy. So he cut a snake stick that was about 7 feet long, and with one fast movement, he pinned the snake with the forked end of the stick. And at that point, the snake exploded in a fury of striking this way and that way, expelling venom in the air, arcs of venom flying through the air. I mean, I have never seen anything like it. This thing had fangs that were more than an inch long, and it was bigger than he was. So he managed to work the stick up behind the snake's head. He grabbed it behind the head. But the snake was twisting its head around, trying to sink its fangs into the back of his hand, and expelled venom all over the back of his hand, and his skin was starting to bubble. Mm. So he wrestled the snake to the ground, which was really difficult. I mean, this snake was longer than he was, and he had to pin it with his knees while holding its head. And then he cut off its head. And the decapitated head continued to snap and spew venom, while the headless snake continued to fight and then tried to crawl off. I mean, I have never in my life seen a scene as horrific as this. It was like something out of a horror film. And then, you know, being British, he stood up, he washed his hands off right away, and he said, nothing like that to concentrate the mind, is there? And then he said he was very sorry he couldn't move it, but when the venom was on the back of his hand, he realized he had to get it off as quickly as possible.
And that's your first night in the jungle.
That was just the beginning of the challenges that we faced. I mean, the next day, our anthropologist, a woman named Alicia Gonzalez, almost sank in a pool of quick mud. And we almost lost her. I mean, again, it was like something out of a grade B movie. She was, you know, the mud, you have these holes of mud that you have to cross, and they're up to your waist, and it's sucking you down, and you're trying to move in a way that doesn't cause you to be sucked down into this thing. And she was standing there, and in a very calm voice, she said, excuse me, I'm going down. I am really going down. there she was. The bubbles are coming up around her. She's sinking into this mud. And so these SAS guys had to get in there and wrestle her out of the mud. And then the insects came out at night in absolute clouds of them. And you know, I found myself getting into my sleeping bag and completely covered with crawling insects. Freaked me out. I thought, well, maybe this area is all that they described it as.
The area that you explored, you just did a very small part of it. How long will it actually take to explore this area archaeologically in full?
Well, I think it's going to take a long time. In fact, it may never be entirely explored because it turns out the valley was a hot zone of disease and that affected almost everyone on the expedition, a very dangerous and incurable tropical disease, which has really limited the ability of archaeologists to work there because they get sick.
In a way, the curse is still alive. I understand that you came down with the disease yourself.
Well, we did. I did. The National Geographic photographer did. The archaeologist did. Hondurans and Americans alike came down to this disease called leishmaniasis, a very bad form of it called mucocutaneous leishmaniasis, which, I don't want to revolt your listeners too much, but it's essentially a flesh-eating disease. It's like leprosy. It's transmitted by the bite of a sandfly, but the parasites, it's a single-celled animal, migrate to your face, and they eat away your nose and your lips until they fall off and leave your face an open, weeping sore. And then they eat away the bones of your face and create a hole in your head, which, you know, eventually you die. Now, that happens if you're untreated. We got treated. It's a really horrible treatment. It doesn't cure the disease, but at least it beats it back. So we're okay. But it was pretty rough on some people. In fact, the Honduran archaeologist nearly died of it.
So you're saying they were not Mayans. Then who were they?
Well, they were their own civilization. They certainly traded with the Maya, but when Copan and the Maya realm collapsed in 900 AD, this civilization had a sudden flowering. And that's when they built these great cities after the Maya collapsed. So the big question now is, you know, what happened? Why did they suddenly, you know, have this fluorescence of their civilization? And then in around 1500, why did they suddenly disappear? Not just the city, but the entire civilization collapsed all over La Mosquitia, and these people vanished. They were not conquered by the Spanish. So what happened to them?
Do you have an answer to that?
Well, the archaeologists believe that even though they never made contact with Europeans, that European disease burned deep into the interior of Honduras, probably measles and smallpox, and devastated this entire civilization, probably killing 90% of the people, and the survivors, the 10%, feeling that the gods were angry at them or otherwise feeling devastated by these terrible epidemics, simply walked out of the city. So at the height of the civilization, these people's temples looked as impressive as anything that the Maya built or as impressive as Machu Picchu. But once the cities were abandoned, all the adobe and the wood decayed and went into the earth and disappeared, just leaving behind these great mounds. So it's not quite as spectacular visually as the pyramids of the Maya or the great civilization of Machu Picchu. But they made many beautiful artifacts out of stone, many sculptures. And those are still exist. And I'll never forget the second day of the expedition. One of the people said, hey, you guys, there's some weird stones over here. And we all rushed over and just peeking out of the ground were the tops of dozens and dozens of gorgeous stone sculptures that had been left at the base of this pyramid as an offering. And when this area was excavated, only 200 square feet, they found over 500 gorgeous, beautifully carved stone sculptures and objects out of ceramic, all left at the base of this pyramid as an offering. And the archaeologists were able to determine that all these objects had been left not over time, but at the very end of the city's life. Everyone came and left their sacred objects and then walked out.
what insights did you come away from this experience in terms of civilizations that come and go?
Well, the Mosquitia civilization was remarkable in that it was able to take a very hostile rainforest environment and they transformed it into almost a Garden of Eden. I mean, they cleared out large areas, they leveled the ground and created these large open plazas surrounded by great earthworks, which were the foundations of temples. They had cacao groves, they had groves of fruit trees, they had groves of medicinal plants and also food, and they also had large flower gardens, because flowers, archaeologists believe, are an important part of their ceremonial life. So what these people were able to do was to take this environment and humanize it.
Mr. Preston, thank you very much for the book. It was a pleasure talking to you.